DW Africa Link.
That's right. This is Africa Link program, and we are streaming live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. My name is Jane Nyingi.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura. We are also live on our Facebook page, DW Africa, and on our partner radio stations across the continent. Feel free to engage with us and share this audio. Coming up, the Tanzanian government is on the headlines after the Committee to Protect Journalists launches a campaign pushing it to come clean on the disappearance of journalist Azory Gwanda over 1 year ago.
For us, this is the time for the global community, for journalists, for press freedom organizations like ourselves to speak into solidarity and ask for definitive answers about exactly what happened to Azory.
That still remains a million-dollar question. What really happened to Azory 1 year down the line? Plus, who has won this year's German Africa Prize? Stay tuned for that, because this particular prize had attracted nominees from over 18 countries across the continent.
Before we get all that and much more, let's first hear what has been happening across the globe.
DW News.
I'm Kai Dombach with the DW News. A preliminary report on the Ethiopian Airlines plane that crashed last month says the pilots followed proper emergency procedures. Following the investigation, Ethiopian Transport Minister Dagmawit Moges had two safety recommendations.
The first one is, since repetitive, uncommanded aircraft nose-down conditions are noticed in this preliminary investigation, it is recommended that the aircraft flight control system related to the flight controllability shall be reviewed by the manufacturer. And the second one is, aviation authorities shall verify that the review of the aircraft flight control system related to flight controllability has been adequately addressed by the manufacturer before release of the aircraft to operations.
The crash killed all 157 passengers and crew on board shortly after takeoff. A Congolese rebel leader accused of orchestrating mass rapes and other atrocities has been caught. The Democratic Republic of Congo's army said Thursday that Masudi Alimasi Kokodiko, leader of the Raia Mutomboki militia, was captured after he was injured in a firefight. The militia became a powerful force in the eastern part of the country. A Vatican tribunal has upheld its conviction of Guam's ousted archbishop for sexually assaulting minors. Archbishop Anthony Operon has been removed from office and prohibited from living in Guam, a remote U.S. Pacific territory. The Vatican said the decision can no longer be challenged on appeal. Operon denied any wrongdoing. This news comes to you from Deutsche Welle, Germany's international public broadcaster. New Zealand police said Thursday that the man accused of killing 50 Muslims in Christchurch last month will be charged with 50 counts of murder and 39 counts of attempted murder. The charges will be formally read out at a court session scheduled for Friday. New Zealand police said other charges were still under consideration. 24 people are still in hospital receiving treatment for injuries caused by the shooting. The European Union has condemned Venezuela for its decision to strip self-declared President Juan Guaido of his parliamentary immunity. In a statement on Thursday, EU diplomatic chief Federica Mogherini said it was a violation of the country's constitution and reduces the chances of a peaceful end to the economic and political crises in Venezuela. The move to remove Guaido's diplomatic immunity could lead to his prosecution and potential arrest for violating an order to not leave the country. And in sports, Bayern Munich survived a tough challenge from FC Heidenheim to make it to the DFB Pokal semifinals. Heidenheim took a 2-1 lead over the Bavarians into halftime and kept a 4-4 tie with under 10 minutes left until Robert Lewandowski scored a penalty in the 84th minute. Werder Bremen also punched their ticket into the semifinals with two second-half goals over Schalke 04. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Kai Dombach.
And this is Africa Link program, and we are live from our studios in Bonn, Germany.
And we go right away to our top story. It's now over a year since the disappearance of Tanzanian journalist Azory Gwanda under mysterious circumstances. The government has remained silent, forcing the Committee to Protect Journalists CPJ to intervene. Today, the New York-based organization launched a massive campaign pressurizing the Tanzanian government to start a proper investigation into his disappearance.
In a statement, the CPJ said the campaign will be known as Where is Azory? On the line, I'm joined by Muthoki Mumo, CPJ Sub-Saharan Africa representative. Thanks so much for coming through, Muthoki. Why is this campaign being launched now, over a year since Azory's disappearance?
Like you've said, it's been over a year since he went missing in the coast region of Tanzania. Without knowing credibly what happened to him and what his fate was. So for us, this is the time for the global community, for journalists, for press freedom organizations like ourselves to speak into solidarity and ask for definitive answers about exactly what happened to Azory. He has been missing for so long that it's 500 days now, is why we are launching this campaign to ask for answers.
How will it be conducted?
What we are doing right now is we've reached out to the media to ask for coverage, but we're also calling on journalists themselves, on the global community, on Tanzanian press freedom organizations, on international press freedom organizations, to speak with one voice in solidarity on social media and in whatever networks they're on, to ask the government to provide definitive answers for the question, where is Azory?
We are aware the Tanzanian government has been very reluctant to launch proper investigations into Azory's disappearance. Do you think this campaign will change things?
We hope that once they see that there's appetite from a global community and that there's solidarity, they will be able to publicly account for what happened to him. You know, we cannot give up hope.
Now, it's alleged that the journalist might have been killed for being critical of the government. Has this in any way affected press freedom in Tanzania?
What we've seen in recent years in Tanzania is that the press freedom situation has deteriorated drastically. And from what CPJ has seen in its research and in talking with people, it's that journalists do wonder if this can happen to Azory. What does that mean for the rest of us who are reporting critically?
As you've said, the press freedom situation doesn't look really good in Tanzania. As CPJ, have you thought of engaging the government?
Yes, of course. We have thought of engaging them and we look forward to engaging with them in the future. Last year, CPJ was part of two different groups that wrote letters urging the Tanzanian governments to ease up the crackdown on press freedom in Tanzania. So that's one way in which we've communicated to the Tanzanian government. Later in the year, after the incident in which I and a colleague of mine were briefly detained in Tanzania, we also wrote an open letter to the president about that incident, but also about the press freedom conditions in Tanzania.
I was speaking to Muthoki Mumo, CPJ's Sub-Saharan Africa representative. And Zippy, there is a lot of reaction on that on our Facebook page. What are people saying?
For sure. I'll start right away with Mo Kramer from Ghana, who is saying, this is sad and it has the propensity to put fear in other journalists, paving a way of total silence in the media sector. He says this is not good for any democracy.
Sad indeed. So keep talking to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Moving on, NATO foreign ministers are meeting in Washington to celebrate the alliance's 70th anniversary amid rifts between members over security and trade issues. Among some of the key issues on the table are coming up with measures to deter Russian aggression and agreeing on a package of measures to bolster NATO's military presence in the Black Sea.
However, there are new challenges like fighting uncontrolled migration and China's strategic competition. I talked to our NATO correspondent, Terry Schultz, who is following the proceedings in Washington.
What we hear time and again now as the future challenge is not even Russia, not even hybrid warfare tactics. What they're really talking about in the future is China's economic dominance of Europe. The fact that China is, you know, the first to come out with 5G technology, meaning that if governments want that very high speed connectivity. They basically have to go with a Chinese company, Huawei, at the moment. And that makes some countries, primarily the United States, uncomfortable. Also, China is buying up utilities in Europe, and it's coming to terms with this quite late, according to some of the experts I speak with. They should have been on this before, making deals with China or even pressing allies not to sell stakes in some of these very important resources to China.
Of course, NATO has also been a strong ally and supporter of Africa Union. What are some of the relevant topics you think will be affecting or touching on Africa?
Well, they don't actually mention Africa, from what I've heard. Of course, there's not much of the meeting that's public. But Africa's very concerned by the rise of terrorism, the fact that these terrorist organizations, you know, commandeer so much of the natural resources and you know, also give countries a bad name. And you have countries that NATO is concerned about and does keep its eye on, like Libya. Of course, we know what happened in Libya with the fall of Gaddafi and NATO's role in that. So they're very much worried about the fact that Libya would become one of the new lawless areas where even ISIS fighters could run and hide. We know that's happening. We know that it's a mecca for weapons. And so as the counter-ISIS coalition, as the United States push the Islamic State out of some areas, the fear is that they run to places like Libya and set up shop again. So I think that's something that, that Africa and NATO are going to be on, you know, have some common cause in.
That is DW's Terry Schulz, who's following up that meeting of the NATO foreign ministers. And now moving on to another story. There is breaking news because the winner of this year's German Africa Prize has been announced in Nairobi. This is a prize awarded annually to an outstanding African personality.
And the winner is Juliana Rotich, the Kenyan founder of the online platform Ushahidi, which was created to compile and monitor reports of post-election violence after 2007 Kenyan elections. But that's only part of her story. DW's Susan Holton has this portrait.
Juliana Rotich became known in professional circles in 2007 as the co-founder of the open-source platform Ushahidi, a Swahili word meaning testimony. It began in Kenya as an internet platform developed to map reports of post-election violence and went on to revolutionize the international flow of data and information. Today, Ushahidi is used in over 160 countries as a tool for crisis response and for independent election monitoring, for example in Nigeria and Afghanistan. It has also been used following natural disasters in Chile, Haiti and New Zealand. Juliana Rotich is regarded as one of the leading figures of the digital revolution in Africa and beyond. From Ushahidi, she went on to found BRCK, BRIC, an innovative technology company which is now the biggest Wi-Fi provider in sub-Saharan Africa. The central product is a battery-operated modem which can function for up to 8 hours without electrical power. It's used in 150 countries. Rotich is internationally in demand for her IT expertise and acts as a consultant to the German chemical manufacturer BASF, among others. A 16-member jury selected Rotich from a list of 18 African nominees for the prize. The 42-year-old was informed at a meeting today at the German embassy in Nairobi. The award pays tribute to the entrepreneur not only for her business achievements and technological innovations, but also for her outstanding sense of social responsibility. Since 1993, the German Africa Foundation has awarded the German Africa Prize annually to honour outstanding individuals for their long-standing endeavours to foster democracy, peace, human rights, art, culture, the social market economy and social concerns. It is also intended to contribute to the understanding of Africa in Germany.
DW's Susan Holton, and we've gotten a lot of comments on that. Norbert Anquin says, congrats.
And we have Nelly Linda Cherotich, who is saying, wow, this is very brilliant. So the people are very excited. And of course, Kenyans, I see most of the comments are from Kenya.
Absolutely. Barakano Walson says, congratulations to the wonderful Kenyan lady.
Yeah, and Jane, I'm just looking that it has really, what she started has now extended to other countries. It's being used in Chile, Japan,
wow.
New Zealand, Australia, Pakistan, and even Tanzania, many other countries.
It's really good to hear that staff from Africa are being used also in other parts of the globe.
Yeah, for sure. You can also tell us what you think on DW Africa.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to DW's Africa Link program. My name is Jane Nyinge.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura. A warm welcome to all of you listening to us there on our Facebook Live, DW Africa. Ronald Bogba is saying, greetings to DW Africa. You are doing a great job. Thank you very much for your compliments. Ishmael Koroma is talking about the attacks on journalists, and he says, this is an attack on the freedom of expression. Thank you very much for your comments. You can continue giving us your feedback on these stories we are talking about.
Absolutely. Coming up, we will be hearing about the controversial topic of discoveries in Africa. We are asking, when are they valid? Is it only or mostly when made by white explorers?
I think it's a bit unfair because these places were already known by the locals, and they even had local names for these places.
So before we lose those people in their entirety, there is a need to have the record set straight for oncoming generations.
Make sure you do not miss that interesting piece. But first we head to South Sudan. For the first time in nearly 9 years of its independence, the Juba government, supported by the United Nations, has created a mobile court to try rapists in the country's remote northern region of Unity.
The United Nations says the mobile court has brought legal justice to the oil-rich region west of the White Nile, where rape suspects have remained in remand for more than 1 year without trial. To tell us more, here is James Shimanyula.
As the saying goes, justice delayed is justice denied. More than 30 rape suspects have been languishing without a trial in the town of Bentiu in South Sudan's northern region of Unity. That will now change with the arrival of the mobile court. The court comprises two judges, two prosecutors, one investigator, and two defense lawyers. It is located in the United Nations Protection of Civilians compound in Bentiu. In one of the first cases, Judge Maro Deng jailed a 32-year-old man for 3 years after finding him guilty on charges of indecently assaulting a woman with the purpose of raping her.
Convict Albino Simon Umot, you are hereby sentenced to imprisonment for 3 years, made under my hand, mobile court.
Unity region is the part of the country with the highest number of rape victims. Rupert Colville, spokesman for the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, provides some figures.
Obviously not the whole picture, but 174 women and girls who'd been raped, gang raped or sexually assaulted. 49 of those girls who were raped were children.
Citing the testimony of one rape victim, Colville said many women are raped while fetching firewood or looking for food or water.
She said, we women do not have a choice. There's no alternative for us. If we go by the main road, we are raped. Go by the bush, we are raped. I was raped, among others, in the same area repeatedly on 3 different occasions. We avoided the road because we heard horrible stories that women and girls are grabbed while passing through and are raped. The same happened to us. There's no escape.
Zainabu Hawa Bangura is the United Nations Special Representative on Sexual Violence. She explains why rapists commit sexual violence.
Sexual violence is to punish the victim, to degrade them, to humiliate them to a level where they cannot be able to pick up the pieces of their life. The message is sent very clearly to perpetrators that wherever you are, when you commit this crime, whoever you are, we will get you.
The surge in conflict-related sexual violence in South Sudan is attributed by United Nations officials in Juba to the breakdown in the rule of law linked to the destruction of livelihoods, forced displacement, and food insecurity after many years of civil war and the large number of fighters who are yet to be integrated into the National Army as per the new peace pact signed last year in Khartoum, Sudan.
James Shimanyula with that report. And Osei Prepper on our Facebook page, DW Africa, says the trial of the perpetrators of these crimes is long overdue. Such people needed to be punished severely because they have really taken the women and female children through a lot of psychological trauma. So keep talking to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
Speaking out.
We now head to South Africa, where recent attacks on foreign nationals have generated a huge debate in the country, forcing the government to bring together representatives of other African countries to reassure them that the government is not xenophobic and it's taking action to end the attacks against other Africans.
The government insists the attacks were criminal in nature, but as Tuzo Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, many believe this denialism is the reason why South Africa has failed to deal with such attacks in the past.
South Africa this week found itself forced to call a meeting of African ambassadors and high commissioners after yet another eruption of xenophobic violence emerged in Durban and Limpopo province. In Durban, locals attacked Malawian nationals in three suburbs after four of them were accused of stealing from a local resident. Up to 100 Malawians sought refuge at a local police station. A few days later, seven trucks were set alight in Durban after locals protested against the employment of foreign truck drivers. Around the same time, several houses and a motor vehicle were burnt in the Limpopo province. They belonged to Zimbabweans who were accused of committing criminal acts. The South African government does not accept that these were xenophobic attacks. Lindiwe Sisulu, Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, made this comment.
We repeat what the President has said. What happened over the weekend, we believe, with the information available to us, was pure criminality.
These comments started a heated debate, with foreigners in the country accusing South Africa of denialism. Emeka Ogu is the Welfare Secretary of the All Nigerian Nationals in Diaspora South Africa.
I don't know what else to call it other than xenophobia. And to be more specific, these attacks are usually on foreigners of African origin.
Human Rights Watch Southern Africa Director Deoma Vinga says denying the existence of xenophobia will only frustrate efforts to root it out.
The common theme is the targeting of foreign nationals. And it is agreed in the National Action Plan of South Africa that xenophobia is that attitudinal hostility and actions of hostility towards non-nationals in a particular population.
Zimbabwean national Gretman Mkwebu agrees.
The real truth, this thing is a real xenophobia. Because wherever we are, either in taxis, streets, locations where we stay, we hear South Africans speak openly that foreigners must go back to their countries. So the government is ashamed to tell the world the truth because this thing is a shame.
Up to 60 lives were lost when xenophobic violence erupted across South Africa in 2008. Since 2014, attacks in different parts of the country have become a regular occurrence.
Tuzo Kumalo with that report. Zippy, do we have anything on that?
Of course, we've been getting a lot of reaction and input from our listeners there. Chenzi Onyeriba wrote to us and said, it's time to love one another, protect one another, my African brothers and sisters. A very good input there. And we have many more, of course. We cannot read all of them, but keep telling us what you think about these stories, which continues to grab the headlines, not just in South Africa, but in the whole continent as a large.
Get personal with DW Africa on WhatsApp and don't miss out on any news and videos from us. Go to dw.com/africa and find out how to join our WhatsApp service.
And as promised, I can still see we have many other comments there. Roger Makawa said, no wonder both, he says that those who always feel entitled, most of the time we do nothing to improve the situation. All they do is blame others for their laziness. He's talking about South Africa and, of course, the attacks on other Africans. Thank you very much for your comments. We are happy to read them when we can.
U-Zone.
Now, Africa has always been known as the cradle of mankind and the land of great ancient civilizations, which is why early European explorers visited the continent fascinated by its rich archaeological sites.
Now, they often documented and reported to have discovered these places and sites, despite the fact that they found people living there. However, young people are questioning the validity of these discoveries, the latest being the purported sighting of a black leopard in Kenya after 100 years. For more, here is Assumpta Latus with that report.
I think that always bothers me when they say discover. I think if they had a word for it, like...
It's a debate that sparks emotions, not just among these two Zimbabweans, but among young people across the continent. Nyansha Shirinda and Kimberly Coote are not happy that a Scottish explorer, David Livingstone, is credited to have discovered the Victoria Falls, which he named it in honour of Queen Victoria of Britain.
I think it's a bit unfair to ascribe discovery of, you know, these places like Victoria Falls to foreigners, because these places were already known by the locals, and they even had local names for these places. The dominant narrative is really Eurocentric.
David Livingstone did not discover. He did not make people of Zimbabwe and Zambia aware. Okay. We had our own Nyami Nyami, the goddess of the water. So how did people know that there was a goddess in the water if they didn't know?
The young people are now proposing rewriting of their history books to tell their own African stories.
As people pass away, there's a danger of the history being eroded. So before we lose those people in their entirety, there's a need to have the record set straight for oncoming generations who have nothing to rely on other than the history books.
It's very important to start the process of rewriting the history. It starts with us, the Africans. If we just publicize it to say Mosia Tunya, at first maybe we can say Mosia Tunya, also known as the Victoria Falls. But as the years go by, we start referring to it as Mosia Tunya. People will get used to that.
In West Africa, controversy about who discovered the river Niger remains unresolved. Local people had given it different names, like the Igbo, who called Orimili or Orimili, which means great water, and Kwara in Hausa. It's documented to have been discovered by a Scottish explorer, Mungo Park. However, according to Dr. Dan Ekere from the University of Lagos, local people were making a livelihood out of it even before he came.
One thing that you must respect about the West is that they have a way of documenting issues, and they have facilities, state-of-the-art facilities, to do all of that. For instance, you have a scenario in which somebody visited Nigeria, particularly Mungo Park, and it was recorded in history for us that Mungo Park discovered the River Niger. And it will amaze you that as at the time Mungo Park came to Nigeria, people around the Niger, in fact, the River Niger constituted a source of life to the people of the area. So was it that the river was covered and Mungo Park unveiled it? Was it that there was nobody in the area and only Mungo Park sailed through the river? No.
Ekere, who is a psychology lecturer with vast interest on the topic, says Africa should invest more in research to avoid lagging behind. European exploration in Africa was the highlight during the scramble for Africa and the colonization period. They were naming places after their monarchies, such as Lake Albert, which is shared between Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, originally known as Mtanzige by the Banyoro and Batoro, or Lake Victoria, which was known by locals as Nam Lolwe in Kenya, Nalubale in Uganda, and Nyanza in Tanzania.
Assumpta Latos with that report, and you can get more of that on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/DW Africa. And Zippy, we've gotten a lot of comments on that.
For sure. I will start with Manasseh Samuel, who is saying, bunch of lies. I believe that there were villagers who led Mungo Park, the Scottish who is said to have discovered River Niger, to the river. It's because they were illiterate that they could not put history on a paper.
And an interesting one here from Kasije, Innocent. He says a certain white man called John Speck came to Uganda and suggested to have discovered Lake Victoria, which is the source of the Nile River. Yet there were inhabitants of the area around there. So he calls it total madness.
Yeah, of course, many people are refuting that. And Epanti said, just as Columbus discovered America, they were intelligent to document and make it known to others. So thank you very much for your comments. You can also tell us what you think right there on DW Africa.
And with that, we come to the end of this show. My name is Jane Nyingi.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura. Bye for now.
DW, made for mind.